You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Viral Inflection by Katherine Aben. In February 2020, a research paper co-authored by two Chinese scientists based at separate Wuhan universities appeared online as a preprint. It tackled a fundamental question: how did a novel bat coronavirus get to a major metropolis of 11 million people in central China in the dead of winter, when most bats were hibernating, and turn a market where bats weren't sold into the epicenter of an outbreak? The paper offered an answer. We screened the area around the seafood market and identified two laboratories conducting research on bat coronavirus. The first was the Wuhan Center for Disease Control and Prevention, which sat just 280 meters from the Huanan market and had been known to collect hundreds of bat samples. The second was the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The paper came to a staggeringly blunt conclusion about COVID-19. The killer coronavirus probably originated from a laboratory in Wuhan. Almost as soon as the paper appeared on the internet, it disappeared, but not before U.S. government officials took note. By then, Pottinger had approved a COVID-19 origins team run by the NSC directorate that oversaw issues related to weapons of mass destruction. A longtime Asia expert and former journalist, Pottinger purposefully kept the team small because there were so many people within the government wholly discounting the possibility of a lab leak, he said. In addition, many leading experts had either received or approved funding for gain-of-function research. Their conflicted status, said Pottinger, had the effect of contaminating the shot at having an impartial inquiry. As they combed open sources, as well as classified information, the team soon stumbled on a 2015 research paper by Xi Zhengli and the University of North Carolina epidemiologist Ralph Barrick, proving that the spike protein of a novel coronavirus could infect human cells. Using mice as subjects, they inserted the protein from a Chinese rufous horseshoe bat virus into the molecular structure of the SARS virus from 2002, creating a new infectious pathogen. The gain-of-function experiment was so fraught that the authors flagged the danger themselves, writing, "Scientific review panels may deem similar studies too risky to pursue." In fact, the study was intended to raise an alarm and warn the world of a potential risk of SARS-CoV reemergence from viruses currently circulating in bat populations. The paper's acknowledgments cited funding from the U.S. National Institutes of Health and from a nonprofit called Eco Health Alliance, which had parceled out grant money from the U.S. Agency for International Development. Eco Health Alliance is run by Peter Daszak, the zoologist who helped organize the Lancet statement. That a genetically engineered virus might have escaped from the WIV was one alarming scenario, but it could also be possible for a natural virus collected in the field to leak from a lab. The NSC investigators found ready evidence that China's labs were not as safe as advertised. She herself had publicly acknowledged that, until the pandemic, all of her team's coronavirus research, some involving live SARS-like viruses, had been conducted in less secure BSL-3 and even BSL-2 laboratories. In 2018, A delegation of American diplomats reported that a shortage of highly trained technicians and clear protocols at the WIV's new BSL-4 lab threatened its safe operations. The issues had not stopped the WIV's leadership from declaring the lab ready for research on Class 4 pathogens, P4, among which are the most virulent viruses that pose a high risk of aerosolized person-to-person transmission. On February 14, 2020, to the surprise of NSC officials, President Xi Jinping of China announced a plan to fast-track a new biosecurity law to tighten safety procedures throughout the country's laboratories. Was this a response to confidential information? In the early weeks of the pandemic, it didn't seem crazy to wonder if this thing came out of a lab, Pottinger reflected. Apparently, it didn't seem crazy to Xi either. A Scientific American article first published in March 2020, for which she was interviewed, described how her lab had been the first to sequence the virus in those terrible first weeks. It also recounted how she frantically went through her own lab's records from the past few years to check for any mishandling of experimental materials, especially during disposal. She breathed a sigh of relief when the results came back. None of the sequences matched those of the viruses her team had sampled from bat caves. That really took a load off my mind, she says. I had not slept a wink for days. As the NSC tracked these disparate clues, U.S. government virologists advising them flagged one study first submitted in April 2020. 11 of its 23 co-authors worked for the Academy of Military Medical Sciences, the Chinese Army's Medical Research Institute. Using the gene editing technology known as CRISPR, the researchers had engineered mice with humanized lungs, then studied their susceptibility to SARS-CoV-2. As the NSC officials worked backward from the date of publication to establish a timeline for the study, it became clear that the mice had been engineered sometime in the summer of 2019, before the pandemic even started. The NSC officials were left wondering, had the Chinese military been running viruses through humanized mouse models to see which might be infectious to humans? Believing they had uncovered important evidence in favor of the lab leak hypothesis, the NSC investigators began reaching out to other agencies. The response was very negative, said Anthony Ruggiero, the NSC's senior director for counterproliferation and biodefense. We were dismissed. 6. Sticklers for accuracy. By the summer of 2020, Gilles Demirneuf was spending up to 4 hours a day researching the origins of COVID-19. He began to receive anonymous calls and notice strange activity on his computer, which he attributed to Chinese government surveillance. We are being monitored for sure, he says. He moved his work to the encrypted platforms Signal and ProtonMail. As they posted their findings, the drastic researchers attracted new allies. Among the most prominent was Jamie Metzl, who launched a blog on April 16th that became a go-to site for examining the lab leak hypothesis. Metzl sits on the World Health Organization's Advisory Committee on Human Genome Editing and served in the Clinton administration as the NSC's Director for Multilateral Affairs. In his first post, he made clear that he had no definitive proof and noted, "In no way do I seek to support or align myself with any activities that may be considered unfair, dishonest, nationalistic, racist, bigoted, or biased in any way." On December 11, 2020, Demirneuf, a stickler for accuracy, reached out to Metzl to alert him to a mistake on his blog. The 2004 SARS lab escape in Beijing, Demirneuf pointed out, had led to 11 infections, not 4. Demirneuf was impressed by Metzl's immediate willingness to correct the information. From that time, we started working together. Metzl, in turn, was in touch with the Paris Group, a collective of more than 30 skeptical scientific experts who met by Zoom once a month for hours-long meetings to hash out emerging clues. Alina Chan, a young molecular biologist and postdoctoral fellow at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, found that early sequences of the virus showed very little evidence of mutation. Had the virus jumped from animals to humans, one would expect to see numerous adaptations, as was true in the 2002 SARS outbreak. To Chan, it appeared that SARS-CoV-2 was already pre-adapted to human transmission, she wrote in a preprint paper in May 2020. But perhaps the most startling find was made by an anonymous drastic researcher known on Twitter as @TheSeeker268. The Seeker, as it turns out, is a young former science teacher from India. He had begun plugging keywords into the China National Knowledge Infrastructure, a website that houses papers from 2,000 Chinese journals, and running the results through Google Translate. One day, that May, he fished up a thesis from 2013 written by a master's student in Kunming, China. The thesis opened an extraordinary window into a bat-filled mineshaft in Yunnan province and raised sharp questions about what she had failed to mention in the course of making her denials. 7. The Mojang Miners. In 2012, six miners in the lush mountains of Mojang County in southern Yunnan province were assigned an unenviable task: to shovel out a thick carpet of bat feces from the floor of a mine shaft. After weeks of work, the miners became gravely ill and were sent to the hospital at the Kunming Medical University in Yunnan's capital. Their symptoms of cough, fever, and labored breathing rang alarm bells in a country that had suffered through a viral SARS outbreak a decade earlier. The hospital called in a pulmonologist, Zhang Nanshan, who had played a prominent role in treating SARS patients. Zhang, according to the 2013 master's thesis, immediately suspected a viral infection. He asked what kind of bat had produced the guano. The answer, the Rufous horseshoe bat, the same species implicated in the first SARS outbreak. Within months, three of the six miners were dead. The eldest, who was 63, died first. The disease was acute and fierce, the thesis noted. It concluded the bat that caused the six patients to fall ill was the Chinese rufous horseshoe bat. Blood samples were sent to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which found that they were positive for SARS antibodies, a later Chinese dissertation documented. But there was a mystery at the heart of the diagnosis. Bat coronaviruses were not known to harm humans. What was so different about the strains from inside the cave? To find out, teams of researchers from across China and beyond traveled to the abandoned mine shaft to collect viral samples from bats, musk shrews, and rats. In an October 2013 Nature study, she reported a key discovery. Certain bat viruses could potentially infect humans without first jumping to an intermediate animal. By isolating a live SARS-like bat coronavirus for the first time, her team found it could enter human cells through a protein called the ACE2 receptor. In subsequent studies in 2014 and 2016, she and her colleagues continued studying samples of bat viruses collected from the mine shaft, hoping to figure out which one had infected the miners. The bats were bristling with coronaviruses, but only one closely resembled SARS. The researchers named it RABTCoV-4991. On February 3, 2020, with the COVID-19 outbreak already spreading beyond China, she and several colleagues published a paper noting that the SARS-CoV-2 virus's genetic code was almost 80% identical to that of SARS-CoV, which caused the 2002 outbreak. but they also reported that it was 96.2% identical to a coronavirus sequence in their possession called RATG13, which was previously detected in Yunnan province. They concluded that RATG13 was the closest known relative to SARS-CoV-2. In the following months, as researchers around the world hunted for any known bat virus that might be a progenitor of SARS-CoV-2, she offered shifting and sometimes contradictory accounts of where RATG13 had come from. Several teams, including a group of drastic researchers, soon realized that RATG13 appeared identical to RABTCoV-4991, the virus from the shaft where the miners fell ill in 2012 with what looked like COVID-19. In July, as questions mounted, she told Science magazine that her lab had renamed the sample for clarity. But to skeptics, the renaming exercise looked like an effort to hide the sample's connection to the Mojang mine. Their questions multiplied the following month when she, Dazek, and their colleagues published an account of 630 novel coronaviruses they had sampled between 2010 and 2015. Combing through the supplementary data, drastic researchers were stunned to find 8 more viruses from the Mojang mine that were closely related to RATG13, but had not been flagged in the account. Alina Chan of the Broad Institute called the omission mind-boggling. In October 2020, as questions about the Mojang mine shaft intensified, a team of journalists from the BBC tried to access the mine itself. They were tailed by plainclothes police officers and found the road blocked by a broken-down truck. She, by now facing growing scrutiny from the International Press Corps, told the BBC, "I've just downloaded the Kunming Hospital University's student's master's thesis and read it. The conclusion is neither based on evidence nor logic, but it's used by conspiracy theorists to doubt me." 8. The gain-of-function debate. On January 3, 2020, CDC Director Robert Redfield got a phone call from his counterpart, George Fu Gao, head of the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Gao described the appearance of a mysterious new pneumonia, apparently limited to people exposed at a market in Wuhan. Gao assured him there was no human-to-human transmission, says Redfield, who nevertheless urged him to test more widely. That effort prompted a tearful return call. "Many cases had nothing to do with the market," Gao admitted. "The virus appeared to be jumping from person to person. A far scarier scenario." Redfield immediately thought of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. A team of specialists could rule it out as a source of the outbreak in just a few weeks by testing researchers there for antibodies. Redfield repeatedly offered to send help, but Chinese officials didn't respond to his overtures. Redfield, a virologist by training, was suspicious of the WIV, in part because he'd been steeped in the years-long battle over gain-of-function research. The debate engulfed the virology community in 2011 after Ron Fouché, a researcher in Rotterdam, Netherlands, announced that he had genetically altered the H5N1 avian influenza strain to make it transmissible among ferrets, who are genetically closer to humans than mice. He declared it probably one of the most dangerous viruses you could make. In the ensuing uproar, scientists battled over the risk and benefits of such research. Those in favor claimed it could help prevent pandemics by highlighting potential risk and accelerating vaccine development. Critics argued that creating pathogens that didn't exist in nature ran the risk of unleashing them. In October 2014, the Obama administration imposed a moratorium on new funding for gain-of-function research projects that could make influenza, MERS, or SARS viruses more virulent or transmissible. But the moratorium carved out an exception for cases deemed urgently necessary to protect the public health or national security. In the first year of the Trump administration, the moratorium was lifted and replaced with a review system called the HHS P3CO framework for potential pandemic pathogen care and oversight. It put the onus for ensuring the safety of any such research on the federal department or agency funding it. This left the review process shrouded in secrecy. The names of reviewers are not released, and the details of the experiments to be considered are largely secret, said the Harvard epidemiologist Mark Lipsitch. An NIH spokesperson told Vanity Fair that information about individual unfunded applications is not public to preserve confidentiality. Inside the NIH, which funded such research, the P3CO framework was largely met with shrugs and eye rolls, said a longtime agency official. If you ban gain-of-function research, you ban all of virology. He added, ever since the moratorium, everyone's gone wink-wink and just done gain-of-function research anyway. Echo Health Alliance, the New York City-based nonprofit headed by Daszak, has the laudable goal of preventing the outbreak of emerging diseases by safeguarding ecosystems. In May 2014, 5 months before the moratorium on gain-of-function research was announced, EcoHealth secured a grant from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases of roughly $3.7 million, which it allocated in part to various entities engaged in collecting bat samples and performing gain-of-function experiments to see which animal viruses could potentially jump to humans. The grant was not halted under the moratorium for the P3CO framework. By 2018, EcoHealth Alliance was pulling in up to $15 million a year from an array of federal agencies, including the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, according to tax exemption forms filed with the New York Attorney General's Charities Bureau. Xi Jingli herself listed U.S. government grant support of more than $1.2 million on her CV, $665,000 from the NIH between 2014 and 2019, and $559,500 over the same period from USAID. At least some of those funds were routed through EcoHealth Alliance. EcoHealth Alliance's practice of divvying up large government grants into smaller sub-grants for individual labs and institutions gave it enormous sway within the field of virology. The sums at stake allow it to purchase a lot of omerta from the labs it supports, said Richard Ebright of Rutgers. EcoHealth Alliance and Daszak declined to comment. As the pandemic raged, the collaboration between EcoHealth Alliance and the WIV wound up in the crosshairs of the Trump administration. At a White House COVID-19 press briefing on April 17, 2020, a reporter from the conspiratorial right-wing media outlet Newsmax asked Trump a factually inaccurate question about a $3.7 million NIH grant to a BSL-4 lab in China. Why would the U.S. give a grant like that to China? The reporter asked. Trump responded, we will end that grant very quickly, adding, who was president then, I wonder? A week later, an NIH official notified Daszak in writing that his grant had been terminated. The order had come from the White House. Anthony Fauci later testified before a congressional committee. The decision fueled a firestorm. 81 Nobel laureates in science denounced the decision in an open letter to Trump health officials, and 60 Minutes ran a segment focused on the Trump administration's short-sighted politicization of science. The British-born Daszak, 55, appeared to be the victim of a political hit job orchestrated to blame China, Fauci, and scientists in general for the pandemic, while distracting from the Trump administration's bungled response. "He's basically a wonderful, decent human being," said the NIH official. "To see this happening to him, it really kills me." In July, the NIH attempted to backtrack. It reinstated the grant, but suspended its research activities until EcoHealth Alliance fulfilled 7 conditions, some of which went beyond the nonprofit's purview and seemed to stray into tinfoil hat territory. They included providing information on the apparent disappearance of a WIV researcher who was rumored on social media to be patient zero. But conspiracy-minded Trump officials weren't the only ones looking askance at DASAC. Ebright likened DASAC's model of research, bringing samples from a remote area to an urban one, then sequencing and growing viruses and attempting to genetically modify them to see if they could become more virulent, to looking for a gas leak with a lighted match. It soon emerged, based on emails obtained by a Freedom of Information group called U.S. Right to Know, that DASAC had not only signed but organized the influential Lancet statement with the intention of concealing his role and creating the impression of scientific unanimity. Under the subject line, "No need for you to sign the statement, Ralph," he wrote to 2 scientists, including UNC's Ralph Barrick, who had collaborated with Xi on the gain-of-function study that created a coronavirus capable of infecting human cells. "You, me, and him should not sign this statement, so it has some distance from us and therefore doesn't work in a counterproductive way." Dezek added, "We'll then put it out in a way that doesn't link it back to our collaboration so we maximize an independent voice." Barrick agreed, writing back, "Otherwise it looks self-serving and we lose impact." Barrick did not sign. In addition to DASAC, at least 6 other signers had either worked at or had been funded by EcoHealth Alliance. The statement ended with a declaration of objectivity. "We declare no competing interest." DASAC mobilized so quickly for a reason, said Jamie Metzl of the WHO Advisory Committee. "If zoonosis was the origin, it was a validation of his life work. But if the pandemic started as part of a lab leak, it had the potential to do to virology what 3 Mile Island and Chernobyl did to nuclear science. It could mire the field indefinitely in moratoriums and funding restrictions." 9. Dueling memos. In the fall of 2020, the State Department team got a tip from a foreign source. Key information was likely sitting in the U.S. intelligence community's own files, unanalyzed. In November, that lead turned up classified information that was absolutely arresting and shocking, said a former State Department official. 3 WIV researchers, all connected with gain-of-function research on coronaviruses, had fallen ill in November 2019 and appeared to have visited the hospital with symptoms similar to COVID-19, 3 government officials told Vanity Fair. While it is not clear what had sickened them, these were not the janitors, said the former State Department official. They were active researchers. The dates were among the most arresting part of the picture, because they are smack where they would be if this was the origin. The reaction inside the State Department was, "Holy shit," one former senior official recalled. "We should probably tell our bosses." An intelligence analyst working with investigator David Asher turned up a report that outlined why the lab leak hypothesis was plausible. It had been written in May by researchers at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, which performs national security research for the Department of Energy, but it appeared to have been buried within the classified collection system. Now, the officials were beginning to suspect that someone was actually hiding materials supportive of a lab leak explanation. "Why did my contractor have to pour through documents?" Acting Assistant Secretary DiNanno wondered. Their frustration crested in December when they finally briefed Chris Ford acting Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security. He seemed so hostile to their probe that they viewed him as a blinkered functionary bent on whitewashing China's malfeasance. But Ford, who had long been a China hawk, told Vanity Fair that he saw his job as protecting the integrity of any inquiry into COVID-19's origins that fell under his purview. Going with stuff that makes us look like the crackpot brigade would backfire, he believed. There was another reason for his hostility. He'd already heard about the investigation from interagency colleagues rather than from the team itself, and the secrecy left him with a spidey sense. He wondered, had someone launched an unaccountable investigation with the goal of achieving a desired result? He was not the only one with concerns. As one senior government official with knowledge of the State Department's investigation said, they were writing this for certain customers in the Trump administration. After listening to the investigators' findings, a State Department bioweapons expert thought they were bonkers, Ford recalled. The State Department team, for its part, believed that Ford was the one trying to impose a preconceived conclusion that COVID-19 had a natural origin. A week later, one of them attended the meeting where Christopher Park, who worked under Ford, allegedly advised those present not to draw attention to U.S. funding of gain-of-function research. With deep distrust simmering, the State Department team convened a panel of experts to confidentially red-team the lab leak hypothesis. The idea was to pummel the theory and see if it still stood. The panel took place on the evening of January 7th, one day after the insurrection at the Capitol. By then, Ford had announced his plan to resign. 29 people logged on to a secure video call that lasted 3 hours, according to meeting minutes obtained by Vanity Fair. The scientific experts included Ralph Barrick, Alina Chan, and the Stanford microbiologist David Relman. Asher invited Stephen Quay, a breast cancer specialist who'd founded a biopharmaceutical company, to present a statistical analysis weighing the probability of a lab origin versus a natural one. Scissoring Quay's analysis, Barrick noted that its calculations failed to account for many bat coronavirus sequences that exist in nature but remain unknown. When a State Department advisor asked Quay whether he'd ever done a similar analysis, he replied, "There's a first time for everything," according to the meeting minutes. Though they questioned Quay's findings, the scientists saw other reasons to suspect a lab origin. Part of the WIV's mission was to sample the natural world and provide early warnings of human-capable viruses, said Relman. The 2012 infections of the six miners was worthy of banner headlines at the time, yet those cases had never been reported to the WHO. Barrick added that if SARS-CoV-2 had come from a strong animal reservoir, one might have expected to see multiple introduction events rather than a single outbreak, though he cautioned that it didn't prove this was an escape from a laboratory. That prompted Asher to ask, could this not have been partially bioengineered? Ford was so troubled that he stayed up all night summarizing his concerns. The next morning, he emailed a 4-page memo to multiple State Department officials, criticizing the panel's lack of data. He added, "I would also caution you against suggesting that there is anything inherently suspicious and suggestive of biological warfare activity about People's Liberation Army, PLA, involvement at WIV on classified projects, since the U.S. Army has been deeply involved in virus research in the United States for many years." DiNanno sent a 5-page rebuttal to Ford's memo the next day, January 9th. He accused Ford of misrepresenting the panel's efforts and enumerated the obstacles his team had faced: apprehension and contempt from the technical staff, warnings not to investigate the origins of COVID-19 for fear of opening a can of worms and a complete lack of responses to briefings and presentations. A year's worth of mutual suspicions had finally spilled out into two dueling memos. The State Department investigators pushed on, determined to declassify information that had been vetted by the intelligence community. On January 15th, 5 days before Biden's inauguration, the State Department released a fact sheet disclosing key information that several researchers at the WIV had fallen ill with COVID-19-like symptoms in autumn 2019 before the first identified case, and that researchers there had collaborated on secret projects with China's military and engaged in classified research, including laboratory animal experiments, on behalf of the Chinese military since at least 2017. The statement withstood aggressive suspicion, as one former State Department official said, and the Biden administration has not walked it back. "I was very pleased to see Pompeo's statement come through," said Ford, who personally signed off on a draft of the fact sheet. "I was so relieved that they were using real reporting that had been vetted and cleared." 10. Fact-finding in Wuhan. In early July 2020, the WHO invited the U.S. government to recommend experts for a fact-finding mission to Wuhan. Questions about the WHO's independence from China, the country's secrecy, and the raging pandemic had turned the anticipated mission into a minefield of international grudges and suspicion. The U.S. government submitted the names of three experts. None were chosen. Instead, only one representative from the U.S. made the cut, Peter Daszak. It had been evident from the start that China would control who could come and what they would see, what they could see. In July, when the WHO sent member countries a draft of the terms governing the mission, the document was titled CHN and WHO Agreed Final Version, suggesting that China had pre-approved its contents. Part of the fault lay with the Trump administration, which had failed to counter China's control over the scope of the mission when it was being hammered out 2 months earlier. The resolution forged at the WHO's decision-making body, the World Health Assembly, called not for a full inquiry into the origins of the pandemic, but instead for a mission to identify the zoonotic source of the virus. While the Trump administration was huffing and puffing, some really important things were happening around the WHO, and the U.S. didn't have a voice, said Metzl. On January 14, 2021, Daszak and 12 other international experts arrived in Wuhan to join 17 Chinese experts and an entourage of government minders. The inquiry was more propaganda than probe. The team saw almost no raw data, only the Chinese government analysis of it. They paid one visit to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, where they met with Xi Jingli. One obvious demand would have been access to the WIV's database of some 22,000 virus samples and sequences which had been taken offline. At an event in London on March 10th, Daszak was asked whether the group had made such a request. He said there was no need. She had stated that the WIV took down the database due to hacking attempts during the pandemic. "Absolutely reasonable," Daszak said. "As you know, a lot of this work has been conducted with EcoHealth Alliance. We do basically know what's in those databases. There is no evidence of viruses closer to SARS-CoV-2 than RATG13 in those databases." In fact, the database had been taken offline on September 12, 2019, 3 months before the official start of the pandemic, a detail uncovered by Gilles Demirneuf and two Drastic colleagues. The Chinese and international experts concluded their mission by voting with a show of hands on which origin scenario seemed most probable. Direct transmission from bat to human, possible to likely. Transmission through an intermediate animal, likely to very likely. Transmission through frozen food, possible. Transmission through a laboratory incident, extremely unlikely. On March 30th, 2021, the mission's 120-page report was released. Discussion of a lab leak took up less than 2 pages. The report recounted how she rebutted conspiracy theories and told the visiting team of experts that there had been no reports of unusual diseases, none diagnosed, and all staff tested negative for SARS-CoV-2 antibodies. Her statement directly contradicted the findings summarized in the January 15th State Department fact sheet. That was a willful lie by people who know it's not true, a former national security official said of Xi's claim. An internal U.S. government analysis of the mission's report obtained by Vanity Fair found it to be inaccurate and even contradictory. Regarding the 4 possible origins, the analysis stated, the report does not include a description of how these hypotheses were generated, would be tested, or how a decision would be made between them to decide that one is more likely than another. It added that a possible laboratory incident received only a cursory look. The report's most surprising critic was WHO Director Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus of Ethiopia, who appeared to acknowledge the report's shortcomings at a press event the day of its release. As far as WHO is concerned, all hypotheses remain on the table, he said. We have not yet found the source of the virus, and we must continue to follow the science. His statement reflected monumental courage, said Metzl. The WHO declined to make Tedros available for an interview. By then, an international coalition of roughly 2 dozen scientists, among them Demirnov and Abright, had found a way around what Metzl described as a wall of rejections by scientific journals. With Metzl's guidance, they began publishing open letters. Their second, issued on April 7th, condemned the mission report and called for a full investigation into the origin of COVID-19. It was picked up widely by national newspapers. A growing number of people were demanding to know what exactly had gone on inside the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Were the claims in the State Department's fact sheet of sick researchers and secret military research accurate? Metzl had managed to question Xi directly a week before the release of the mission report. At a March 23rd online lecture by Xi, hosted by Rutgers Medical School, Metzl asked if she had full knowledge of all the research being done at the WIV and all the viruses held there, and if the U.S. government was correct that classified military research had taken place. She responded, "We heard the rumors that it's claimed in our laboratory we have some project blah blah with Army blah blah, these kinds of rumors, but this is not correct." A major argument against the lab leak theory hinged on the presumption that the WIV was not hiding any virus samples that are closer cousins to SARS-CoV-2. In Metzl's view, if she was lying about the military's involvement or anything else, all bets were off. 11. Inside the Wuhan Institute of Virology. In January 2019, the WIV issued a press release hailing Xi's election as a fellow of the prestigious American Academy of Microbiology, the latest milestone in a glittering scientific career. Xi was a fixture at international virology conferences thanks to her state-of-the-art work, said James LeDuc, the longtime director of the BSL-4 Galveston National Laboratory in Texas. At the international meetings he helped organize, Xi was a regular, along with Barrick. She's a charming person, completely fluent in English and French, said Leduc. Xi's journey to the top of the virology field had begun with treks to remote bat caves in southernmost China. In 2006, she trained at the BSL for Jean-Mario Inserm Laboratory in Lyon, France. She was named director of the WIV Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases in 2011 and its BSL-3 lab director in 2013. It's hard to think of anyone, anywhere, who was better prepared to meet the challenge of COVID-19. On December 30, 2019, at around 7 p.m., she received a call from her boss, the director of the WIV, according to an account she gave to Scientific American. He wanted her to investigate several cases of patients hospitalized with a mysterious pneumonia. Drop whatever you were doing. The next day, her team became one of the first to sequence and identify the ailment as a novel SARS-related coronavirus. By January 21st, she had been appointed to lead the Hubei Province COVID-19 Emergency Scientific Research Expert Group. In a country that exalted its scientists, she had reached a pinnacle. But her ascent came at a cost. There is reason to believe she was hardly free to speak her mind or follow a scientific path that didn't conform to China's party line. Though she had planned to share isolated samples of the virus with her friend Leduc, Beijing officials blocked her, and by mid-January, a team of military scientists led by China's top virologist and biochemical expert, Major General Qin Wei, had set up operations inside the WIV. With bizarre conspiracy theories and legitimate doubts swirling around her, she began lashing out at critics. "I, Xi Zhengli, guarantee on my life that it has nothing to do with our lab," she wrote in a February 2nd post on WeChat, a popular social media app in China. "May I offer some advice to those people who believe and spread bad media rumors? Shut your dirty mouths." Though Xi has portrayed the WIV as a transparent hub of international research beset by false allegations, the State Department's January fact sheet painted a different picture of a facility conducting classified military research and hiding it, which Xi denies. But a former national security official who reviewed U.S. classified materials told Vanity Fair that inside the WIV, military and civilian researchers are doing animal research in the same freaking space. While that, in and of itself, does not prove a lab leak, Xi's alleged lies about it are absolutely material, said a former State Department official. "It speaks to the honesty and credibility of the WIV that they kept this secret." Neither Xi nor the director of the Wuhan Institute of Virology responded to multiple requests for comment by email and phone. As officials at the NSC tracked collaborations between the WIV and military scientists, which stretch back 20 years with 51 co-authored papers, they also took note of a book flagged by a college student in Hong Kong. Written by a team of 18 authors and editors, 11 of whom worked at China's Air Force Medical University, the book, Unnatural Origin of SARS and New Species of Man-Made Viruses as Genetic Bioweapons, explores issues surrounding the development of bioweapons capabilities. The book contains some alarming practical tradecraft. Bioweapon aerosol attacks are best conducted during dawn, dusk, night, or cloudy weather, because ultraviolet rays can damage the pathogens. One of the book's editors has collaborated on 12 scientific papers with researchers at the WIV. The inflammatory idea of SARS-CoV-2 as bioweapon has gained traction as an alt-right conspiracy theory, but civilian research under Xi's supervision that has yet to be made public raises more realistic concerns. Xi's own comments to a science journal and grant information available on a Chinese government database suggest that in the past 3 years, her team has tested two novel but undisclosed bat coronaviruses on humanized mice to gauge their infectiousness. In April 2021, in an editorial in the journal Infectious Diseases and Immunity, she resorted to a familiar tactic to contain the cloud of suspicion enveloping her. She invoked scientific consensus, just as the Lancet statement had. The scientific community strongly dismisses these unproven and misleading speculations and generally accepts that SARS-CoV-2 has a natural origin, she wrote. But Xi's editorial had no muzzling effect. On May 14th, in a statement published in Science magazine, 18 prominent scientists called for a transparent, objective investigation into COVID-19's origins, noting, "We must take hypotheses about both natural and laboratory spillovers seriously." Among the signers was Ralph Barrick. 15 months earlier, he had worked behind the scenes to help Peter Daszak stage manage the Lancet statement. The scientific consensus had been smashed to smithereens. 12. Out of the shadows. By the spring of 2021, the debate over COVID-19's origins had become so noxious that death threats were flying in both directions. In a CNN interview on March 26th, former CDC Director Redfield made a candid admission, "I still think the most likely etiology of this pathogen in Wuhan was from a laboratory, you know, escaped." Redfield added that he believed the release was an accident, not an intentional act. After the interview aired, death threats flooded his inbox. The vitriol came not just from strangers who thought he was being racially insensitive, but also from prominent scientists, some of whom used to be his friends. One said he should wither and die. Daszak was getting death threats too, some from QAnon conspirators. Inside the U.S. government, meanwhile, the lab leak hypothesis had survived the transition from Trump to Biden. On April 15th, Director of National Intelligence Averill Haynes told the House Intelligence Committee that two plausible theories were being weighed, a lab accident or natural emergence. Even so, lab leak talk was mostly confined to right-wing news outlets through April, gleefully flogged by Tucker Carlson and studiously avoided by most of the mainstream media. The ground began to shift on May 2nd, when Nicholas Wade, a former New York Times science writer known in part for writing a controversial book about race, published a lengthy essay on Medium. In it, he analyzed the scientific clues both for and against a lab leak, and excoriated the media for its failure to report on the dueling hypotheses. Wade devoted a full section to the furin cleavage site, a distinctive segment of SARS-CoV-2's genetic code that makes the virus more infectious by allowing it to efficiently enter human cells. Within the scientific community, one thing leapt off the page. Wade quoted one of the world's most famous microbiologists, David Baltimore, saying that he believed the furin cleavage site was the smoking gun for the origin of the virus. Baltimore, a Nobel laureate, was about as far from Steve Bannon and conspiracy theorist as it was possible to get. With questions growing, NIH Director Francis Collins released a statement on May 19th asserting that neither NIH or NIAID have ever approved any grant that would have supported gain-of-function research on coronaviruses that would have increased their transmissibility or lethality for humans. On May 24th, the World Health Assembly kicked off its annual conference. In the weeks leading up to it, a parade of high-profile stories broke, including two front-page reports in the Wall Street Journal. Not surprisingly, the Chinese government fired back during the conference, saying that it would not participate in further inquiries within its borders. On May 28th, 2 days after Biden announced his 90-day intelligence review, the Senate passed a unanimous resolution, which Jamie Metzl helped shape, calling on the WHO to launch a comprehensive investigation into the origins of the virus. Will we ever know the truth? David Relman of Stanford has been advocating for an investigation like the 9/11 Commission to examine COVID-19's origins. But 9/11 took place on one day, he said, whereas this has so many different manifestations, consequences, responses, across nations. All of that makes it a 100-dimensional problem. The bigger problem is that so much time has gone by. With every passing day, he said, the world ages and things get moved and biological signals degrade. China obviously bears responsibility for stonewalling investigators, whether it did so out of sheer authoritarian habit or because it had a lab leak to hide is and may always be unknown. The United States deserves a healthy share of blame as well. Thanks to their unprecedented mendacity and race-baiting, Trump and his allies had no credibility, and the practice of funding risky research via cutouts like EcoHealth Alliance enmeshed leading virologists in conflicts of interest at the exact moment their expertise was most needed. Now, at least, there appears to be the prospect of a level inquiry, the kind Demmerneff and Metzl had wanted from the start. We needed to create a space where all of the hypotheses could be considered, Metzl said. If the lab leak explanation proves accurate, history may credit Demmerneff and his fellow doubters for breaking the dam, not that they have any intention of stopping. They are now knee-deep in examining the WIV's construction orders, sewage output, and cell phone traffic. The thought driving Paris Group co-founder Virginie Courtier forward is simple. There are unanswered questions, she says, and a few human beings know the answers. Additional reporting by Lily Pike with research assistance from Stan Friedman. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Podcasts of this material are available at our website, ncreadingservice.org.